Fridays are amazing. Responsibilities are replaced with possibilities. Dinner date, dancing with your friends, the movies with your roomies. So to help kick off every weekend, MasterCard is bringing back Fareback Fridays to New York. Every Friday until 2020, MasterCard will refund your subway fare when you tap your contactless MasterCard on the 456 between Grand Central and Atlantic Avenue. Not sure if you can tap your MasterCard? Just check that it has the contactless payment icon, then tap and go. So no matter who you're meeting up with this Friday, tap and go with MasterCard. It's the fastest way to start something priceless. Certain terms and conditions apply. Visit MasterCard.com/FarebackFridays to learn more.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your make it on delay of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
We could light a bunch of candles and dance around the kitchen, baby. Pictures of when we were young would hang on the wall. And we'll sit on the stoop, I'll sing love songs to you when we're 80. See, I finally got you now, honey. I won't let you fall. Can I go where you go? Can we always be this close? Forever and ever and ever. Take me out, take me home. Forever and ever, you're my lover.
Kids like remixes. Kids like new versions of songs with people who weren't originally on them. You were hearing Taylor Swift Lover Career Extender Remix featuring Shawn Mendes. This is a relatively craven ploy to squeeze a little bit of life out of Lover, which is still a very good record.
Which is a great song.
Good song. Great, very, and a great album.
I think running it up at adult contemporary radio, I think, you know, sticking around.
Serious dad hits.
Yeah, you know, AC. It's an AC smash. As was Delicate, you know.
I think it's notable that that's where Taylor lives now, but that's maybe a separate episode. This week on Popcast, we are going to talk about a couple things. First, we're going to talk about the recent kerfuffle between Taylor Swift and Big Machine and AKA Scooter and Scott. As far as...
Don't forget the Carlisle Group.
Yo, shouts to the Carlisle Group. Shouts to all my Supreme heads. Every time you buy Supreme now, you're supporting the oppression of Taylor Swift.
And going against AOC.
Yes. Which is more important, really?
Getting deep in it at the top.
We're just right off the rip. So, but the thing that I wanted to focus on with the Taylor thing is how she chose to weaponize her fan army. And basically, Scooter and Scott got doxxed by a bunch of Swifties on Twitter. That was something that I found striking for someone who purports to comport themselves in a kind of publicly ethical manner that seemed potentially irresponsible. Also, later in the episode, we're going to extend this idea a little bit by talking about 2019's contentious artist-critic conflicts.
You're slamming your fists together.
I am.
Together.
I'm punching my fist together.
Because that's the word.
It is the word. I don't need any more words. I just need sounds. And we're going to talk about how certain artists essentially rely on their fan armies to go after people who say potentially untoward, or maybe in one or two of these cases, not even really untoward things about them in reviews or on the internet or Postmates drivers. So we'll come back to that. But first, Taylor activating the Swifties. Joe is here. Hi, Joe. Joe Cascarelli, New York Times pop music reporter.
What's up?
Lindsay Zoladz is here, critic at large.
Yeah.
In the world.
Just out in the world.
A floating critic. A floating critic at Lindsay Zoladz. Holler at her. Everybody knows Joe. Lindsay, longtime podcast, frequent guest. But I wanted to have Lindsay here specifically because I think, especially for the second half of this episode, the kind of like the moral rights of the critic are potentially like under attack. And I was hoping Lindsay would come and, like, vigorously defend. I mean, we'll see.
Maybe that's what I do.
Maybe she'll just stand. Maybe he'll just stand Lizzo, for all I know. Could happen.
I'm not revealing anything yet.
Okay,
stay
fine.
Tuned.
We'll come back to that. Joe, why is Taylor mad? Why this week? We know big picture. What is Scooter Ithaca Partners?
Ithaca Holdings.
Ithaca Holdings.
Is Scooter's Holdings
company. Does anybody have merch? Is there Ithaca Holdings merch?
I don't think so, but we should make some.
I would like Ithaca. Maybe that's the podcast merch.
Yes. Speaking of IP.
Yeah. I would love an Ithaca Holdings tee, like a pocket tee, kind of with the logo situation. Yeah. Okay. Ithaca Holdings t-shirts.
Or you know how like law firms have the fire merch? Like it's always super high quality.
Oh, absolutely.
And like very well designed. Like I'm pretty sure this company with its investment from Carlyle Group can swing something like that.
They probably have like a cool little duffel bag situation, like a small, like a gym duffel.
Probably like a Patagonia collab.
Oh, fire. Oh, like a tech thing.
Yeah.
Oh, with like Patagonia on one part of the chest and like the Ithaca Partners logo, Ithaca Holdings logo.
Mm-hmm.
Yo. Someone's got to make that.
Yeah, this is a project for
All my merch heads at me. We'll figure something out. Anyway. Ithaca Holdings.
So when we last left,
bad faith actor potentially.
When we last left Taylor versus Scooter and Scott and private equity,
as someone texted me, the SBs.
Yes, the SBs. Yeah, SB projects.
Yes, but not the SB dunks.
Right,
just for the record.
Right, which you know, those are the Joe Coscarelli classics.
Yes, it's true. Are you not today? Though.
Yeah, I got some.
Oh, is that what's
that? Yeah. Okay. So some I got SBs.
There you go.
You know, I have a pile of SBs in my closet. When we last left them, Taylor was upset because Scooter Braun, manager to Justin Bieber and Ariana Grande, associate of Kanye West, had purchased Big Machine, which owns her first six studio albums, the master recordings.
And Dan and Shay. When I taste
tequila. And Reba.
And Dan and Shay. When I taste
tequila. And a couple of others, Sheryl Crow.
Maybe Morgan Wallen on Big Machine?
I don't know.
And Dan and Shay. When I taste
tequila. Yeah. Taylor.
I just want Pedro to just drop like three bars of tequila in here.
That's going to happen.
Pedro, just drop three bars of tequila right there. Every time I say Dan and Shay. When I taste tequila.
We could have a button.
I Dan know. I need a Funk Flex soundboard button for Dan and Shay. When I taste tequila.
Taylor wanted to own her past catalog. She now is
eminently reasonable.
Yeah, so she is now a partner with Universal Music Group. Mm-hmm. She owns her master recordings moving forward, beginning with Lover. She does not own From Reputation backwards.
Right.
She basically wrote on Tumblr a few months back that she was not given the chance to buy her masters. That was countered by Scott Borchetta, the owner of
Big Machine,
the founder of Big Machine, her early record label. And since then, you know, it's gone pretty quiet. Taylor, right before the release of Lover, announced that she would be re-recording her catalog to compete with the old versions, essentially making Scooter and Carlyle Group's investment in her catalog less valuable by putting competing versions into the marketplace.
And just for the record, I think we should just briefly segue. Re-recordings will never be exactly as good as the original recordings. That's number one. But in the contemporary Stan streaming ecosystem, the people who are most likely to revisit old recordings are probably your most dedicated fans. And so if you could possibly convince your most dedicated fans to just play the new version instead of the old versions, there may be a way to actually hurt the bottom line of the people who own your masters.
There's also a licensing question in there, right? Say your Netflix is making the romantic comedy of the year to All the Boys I Loved Before 3 or whatever it is.
Noah Centineo Core.
Yeah, and they want You Belong With Me, and they approach Scooter and Big Machine and say, we want You Belong With Me. Taylor, who owns the publishing on that song, the songwriting, might be able to say, why don't you use my version, my new version? So that's potentially what Big Machine is facing. Taylor says she can begin doing this with her first five albums a year from now, so November 2020. She claims that she can start re-recording her music.
Just as a sidebar, Lindsay, do you think that that's a good aesthetic idea?
No, and that's why I love it, and I really want it to happen.
So you want it to happen basically for the biff?
Yeah,
just you want to hear it.
Just the idea of her at age 30 singing our song or Tim McGraw or something, like
it might be really good.
But do you think she'll do a faithful re-record, or do you think she'll do like an adult re-record?
I kind of would want acoustic versions.
I would want an adult re-record.
Yeah, like light re-record, like, you know, a cover, but with some new edge. But I want the twang still.
I definitely do, but I don't know. She might be wanting to do it in like the purely like note for note,
yeah,
texture
like
for
the
texture.
Most Machiavellian way.
It's to just nail every single.
Yeah, it's note. It's so petty, but it's. And it would require so much work and so much studio time and so much money. And that's also, all you, this is why I love it. It's
and can
ridiculous.
You imagine Taylor Swift channeling all her creative energy in like calendar 2021 to just note for note remakes of her earliest records?
It's totally unprecedented. But it's so her at the end of the day. And it so plays into the way she has played this entire game with them. So I don't know if it goes far enough that we get there. But even just the fact that she's threatening to do that is the most Taylor Swift.
Well, Joe and I were talking on the phone yesterday, and my proposition is that she wants to basically devalue the asset to potentially purchase the asset at, I don't know about a fire sale price, but at least at like 70 cents on the dollar or something to basically get everybody else out of the Taylor Swift business. And so I think she's doing everything she can do to publicly devalue the asset.
Right. So, and we'll get there. So basically she has said she's going to do this. That's obviously a threat to the value of the Big Machine catalog, mm-hmm. which is largely based on Taylor
Dan
Swift's
Shay.
Greatest hits. It's
largely based on Dan and Shay. When I taste tequila.
And so in the meantime, we find out in a Tumblr post last week, Taylor has been making these behind-the-scenes moves, right? One is that she's slated to play at the American Music Awards on Sunday.
Never heard of them.
Being named Artist of the Decade and
not a real thing.
Scheduled to perform a medley of her decade, essentially.
Yes, not a real thing. Just you want to finish
the American Music
Awards. Do you want to finish what her demands were? Before I start decimating them?
Yeah.
Okay,
look,
fine.
Well, like, I think probably American Music Awards ratings were, like, not that far below the Grammys last year. Like, I'll just put that out there. I don't have them in front of me, but, like,
it's like the People's Choice Award. You know what I mean? It's like...
But I like how in her notes she was like, I didn't want you guys to find out this way, but I'm the artist of the decade. Like,
No. That we knew. There was a press release about. I didn't want you to find out this way was about the second part, which was the Netflix documentary.
Yes.
Okay.
So Taylor Swift also announced that Netflix had been making a documentary about Taylor Swift.
Right. Who's producing it, though? Like,
I don't
know. Like
we don't have
in-house production.
Dan and Shay.
Dan and Shay.
Yeah.
When I drink.
So for both of those things... Taylor was touching on her old music. So this is where it gets a little wonky. Taylor says that she has been blocked by Big Machine from using her old music, not only in the Netflix documentary, in which they would like to use what the song sounded like,
right.
in addition to, you know, video footage and other things owned by Big Machine, but also that she believes that she would need her old label to sign off on her performance of these old songs on TV, even though typically a label doesn't have anything to do with a live performance. But because this is a television show that can be recorded and re-aired and put online,
posted on YouTube,
et cetera, then the label will need to sign off. And that's a pretty broad reading of a re-recording clause.
Although, do we know if that is Taylor's read of it or if it's Big Machine's read? Because my sense is it was Big Machine's read as communicated through lawyers to Taylor.
Taylor's version is that she was told you cannot perform your old songs at the American Music Awards and you cannot use them in this Netflix documentary unless you agree to not re-record your music in the future and you stop talking bad about Scott and Scooter. This is Taylor's version. Big Machine says, we never said you couldn't perform your old songs. We've continued to license your music to third parties. Both side statements could be a little squishy with the wording, a little careful, very lawyered. Big Machine is denying that they were trying to stop her from playing her songs. She says that they threatened to not let her. I saw an email in which someone from Big Machine said we're denying the use of these songs for the Netflix documentary.
Mm-hmm.
So they did deny it at least once, whether or not that negotiation was ongoing. Maybe that was a bargaining chip. You know,
we've all seen... Yes.
We don't know.
No, we don't know the big picture.
What is going on between these two? The takeaway is that they're both angling on this chessboard.
Yes.
Taylor wants to own her masters. Big Machine wants, A, to be able to license Taylor Swift songs because
that's where their money
where
is.
Their money is, but also to have her not re-record these
right.
songs.
Right. But they're, so the, it is important to understand that these are two combatants who do not actually have the same goal. Taylor's goal, I believe, and this is, we're speculating here, but Taylor's goal, I believe, is to ultimately find a way to be back in control of her art.
Right, of her catalog.
Whether that's a moral choice or a financial choice or a psychological victory, I'm not 100% sure.
It's all those things, yeah, really.
But I think that is what Taylor wants. What Big Machine wants is to leverage this asset. What Scooter, what Ithaca wants is to leverage this asset for every possible dollar that can be drawn out of it.
Sure, and maybe that's long term. Maybe that's not the Netflix documentary, but they want to make the most of Taylor's catalog for many decades to come.
Absolutely. But those are not the same thing. And they're not compatible necessarily. And it makes more sense why Taylor did what she did this week because of her goals, her desires.
Right. So she basically posts on Tumblr. She reveals all of these backroom negotiations, and she says to her fans, I need you to tell Scott, I need you to tell Scooter, I need you to tell their affiliated artists, and I need you to tell the Carlyle Group, I'm paraphrasing, that this isn't right and that I should be in control of my music.
It just occurred to me that there's someone in the Carlyle Group building is like Taylor Swift's Supreme drop.
Wow.
Someone's doing that math right now. Anyway, just, you know, file that away for when that happens like 27 years from now. Activating the fans. We have talked about stans. We have talked about fan armies. We've talked about their destructive power on podcasts previously. I was very struck because it really was a declaration of war, and not just a declaration of war in the court of public opinion, but also there are fewer ways more guaranteed to make someone's life miserable than by sicking hundreds of thousands of basically young kids with a lot of free time and a lot of hate in their hearts on you.
I don't know if I agree with that. What does Scooter have to do? Turn off the comments on his Instagram? Like,
sure.
Shut his voicemail down? Like, maybe they had to unplug the phones at the SP Projects office. Ultimately, I don't know that these fans are any real threat.
But I think it really also speaks to what audiences each of them are playing to.
Sure.
Taylor only is speaking to her fans.
Core.
To her dedicated, her base.
The demo.
That's all she's concerned about. And to go back to the AMAs, I mean, I hate to like break anyone's heart here, but the AMAs are like a fake award show. I mean, it's a Dick Clark Productions driven thing. It's not rooted in like real voting. I'm going to get it.
All award shows are not real.
I know, but I'm going to get some like weird email from Dick Clark Productions, but like whatever. It's not a real award show.
This is John Caramonica's opinion.
This is my opinion. It's not. I've been to the AMAs. I doubt I'll be invited back.
Humble brag.
Yes. Is it a humble brag when you're unhappy about it?
That's like, I hate for you to find out this week, but I've been to the AMAs.
It's just not a real thing. It's a televised event. It's great for the fans.
It's a concert. It's a televised concert.
Yeah, but it's not sort of like later in life, you're not just like, ah, my lifelong dreams fulfilled. I performed on the AMAs.
I don't think the AMAs are the real thing here. They're a false flag.
It's a false flag. No, but again, it's a false flag designed to activate the fans.
So from a strategic perspective, I think the use of the AMAs here by Taylor, and I do believe that, you know, there was some friction about what she could perform on the show as a larger part of the bargaining between the two sides. But I think her leading with that strategically is important because fans do care about seeing Taylor live, and they
yes.
do care about what songs she's going to play. And that's an easier thing to grasp, I think, for your average Taylor Swift fan than the licensing for a Netflix documentary or the long-term health of her and control of her catalog.
Yes.
It's a much more immediate thing to say, I want to show you guys how much I love you by playing mm-hmm. all your favorite songs from the last 10 years, and these guys are trying to stop
yes.
me from doing that. So from a writing perspective and a strategic perspective, I thought that was pretty shrewd, as are most things that Taylor does.
Just to ask a legal question
yeah.
for our experts here, this wouldn't have any bearing on what she played in concert, correct? It's only if it was televised or used
or recorded,
in some other...
Okay.
Yes, so the idea is that Big Machine would say this violates her re-recording provision. Mm, so okay. Presumably, you know, as most standard industry contracts have something to protect the label from the very thing that Taylor has threatened to do, which is to re-record her catalog. And according to Taylor, she says those provisions run out in 2020. And she, for the first five albums.
For a certain set of albums, yeah.
And she, and she's saying that their legal contention is that by playing old songs now, she would be violating that provision before it runs out.
I see.
Now, a wrinkle here is that Taylor has performed old songs online recently. She did Holy Ground on BBC Live Lounge, and she did All Too Well on NPR Tiny Desk. Mm-hmm. So presumably, Big Machine would have either had to approve those things or been upset about them after the fact and said that those, in fact, were a violation of her re-recording. Now, if they were really take this to their logical end, they would sue her for doing that in some way, saying she is in breach of contract. Will it get to that? Probably not.
No.
Again, I think these are
chess moves.
These are chess moves.
Should we listen to a song that would be particularly vulnerable to a bad re-recording?
Sure.
Should we listen to 15?
Go.
Oh, yeah.
Let's listen to 15 and try to imagine, how old is Taylor now? 30?
Almost.
Let's try to imagine a 30-year-old Taylor singing this song.
This is OG version.
Yeah.
Abigail gave everything she had to a boy who changed his mind. And we both cried.
Fridays are amazing. Responsibilities are replaced with possibilities. Dinner date, dancing with your friends, the movies with your roomies. So to help kick off every weekend, MasterCard is bringing back Fareback Fridays to New York. Every Friday until 2020, MasterCard will refund your subway fare when you tap your contactless MasterCard on the 456 between Grand Central and Atlantic Avenue. Not sure if you can tap your MasterCard? Just check that it has the contactless payment icon, then tap and go. So no matter who you're meeting up with this Friday, tap and go with MasterCard. It's the fastest way to start something priceless. Certain terms and conditions apply. Visit MasterCard.com/FarebackFridays to learn more.
We're recording this on the day where Big Machine relented and said...
Or you know. What was going to happen all
of
along,
course.
Which is that they said they came to an agreement with Dick Clark Productions. Any of the artists that Big Machine works with can play their songs on the AMAs.
Dan and Shay.
And they'll be able to be uploaded online or whatever.
Look out for that Dan and Shay performance.
Next decade's artist of the decade.
Absolutely. Because of that, did Taylor win?
Again, I don't think what she wanted was
this.
The AMA's thing specifically. Mm-hmm. I think she wants her master's, and she needs to figure out a way to make life difficult enough for Scooter and Scott and the Carlisle Group that it becomes untenable for them to continue to own her catalog.
Is it morally acceptable to activate your fan armies to essentially dox the people who are your corporate nemeses?
I'm going to leave that to the critics. I don't know. So let's talk about what we saw, right? That was, Thursday night?
Mm-hmm.
What did we see that night? We saw hashtag I stand with Taylor. Yes. That's the number one trend on Twitter.
RIP to Latin Grammys.
If you, yeah, wow. The Latin Grammys got...
They took a real L. Latin Grammys took a real L, and not just for not having a lot of reggaeton representation.
You know, if you went on Tumblr, which is the real home base of the Swifties, you saw a lot of posts about how Scott and Scooter were rats and, you know, Bieber by proxy, yeah, etc. I don't know. What did you guys see? Like, did you feel the wrath of the Swifties? You had to look for it.
Yeah, much. Yeah, you had to look for it. I think that people like Scott and Scooter are maybe the most inured or bulletproof to this particular kind of manipulation. But what I was most concerned about were the kind of ethical implications of, like, outsourcing the warfare and just being like, well, I have basically a bot army, but they're Swifties and they're real people and they will, like, post your real cell phone number.
Right. So we saw some cell phone numbers, yes, posted. We saw some tweets deleted.
I've got them saved. Just right. You know, in case, we need to call
anybody.
Always. Yeah, it's good to hang on to.
Some of those phone numbers seemed real to me from what I know, and some of them seemed not real or just office numbers that you could Google.
Yeah,
which, like,
sure,
maybe, you know, the office line had to be disconnected.
Right.
I don't know if it's still ringing, but
we should call. But, you know, Taylor is someone who has a very intimate relationship with her fans, a very warm and generous relationship. She doesn't generally ask her fans for a lot. She's often giving her
usually
fans.
It's very positive vibes.
Yeah.
As far as a lot of these fan armies go, the Swifties are usually on the warm and cuddlier side.
Yeah. And it felt like a heel turn a little bit to sort of be like, well, you work for me. And your job is to, like, make these guys' lives miserable. That made me uncomfortable.
Lindsay?
I feel conflicted about it because I think that it's a really complicated legal matter that I personally don't fully understand. I'm no expert in entertainment law or whatever.
Yeah,
And I do think where she has framed it, we're getting to what feel like pretty subjective sides of these conversations that it still doesn't feel like as much as both sides are bringing us into the minutiae of what is usually a very private legal matter, I still don't feel like we're getting the truth from
either
party
yeah.
and have an understanding of what is actually going on.
The full picture, at
least.
Yeah,
and I think that Taylor is using her power to spin the narrative in her favor, and because there are more fans of Taylor Swift than there are of just Scooter Braun stans out there. Like, I do think she's found a way to kind of manipulate that for her own good.
Little known fact, the Scott Borscht Shadow Hive is just called the Borscht. I don't know if you guys know that, but it's people know.
Good to
it's
know.
Just
yeah.
Dan and Jen.
Yes. Why not? I think that's fair. But the thing that I kept thinking about was, like, things like this happen literally all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Most artists do not own their masters. I believe that artists should be in control of their art, but also, like, unfortunately, people sign contracts that leave them vulnerable to situations like this. Taylor is by no means the only artist not in control of her masters.
No, she's in the majority.
Yeah, in the
super
vast majority.
Yeah.
Like in the 98% majority.
She has opened a conversation about this thing that's not very often talked about outside of the industry.
Right.
We also need to talk about the fact that Elizabeth Warren tweeted about this.
Right. And in addition to
yes.
it. Yeah.
Yeah. Though I think maybe, you know, no
not,
shots at their social media teams, but I don't think they took away the right lessons from this.
I
don't
agree.
Think maybe private equity is evil. I'll leave that to my colleagues on the third floor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not the Carlyle Group's fault necessarily.
But they're just gunning. Everybody wants that big T-Swift endorsement in 2020. Yeah, the first ever.
But here's my question.
Taylor.
But don't you think that the blunt force of sort of being like, I'm going to activate in a very complicated manner, I'm going to activate basically like the bluntest force pushback, that to me seems... I mean, look, it's all bad faith, but it seems like particularly bad faith and also asymmetric.
Here's my question about the morality of it, right? If you ultimately believe that, and I'm not saying you do, I'm saying if you believed that Taylor Swift is fighting a righteous battle in saying that a young woman who signed a contract, you know, with legal permission and all that at 15 and now has no control over the work that she made, the sort of era-defining art that she made— if you believe that she should own her masters and that the music business is built on the exploitation of young women and people of color,
of
and et cetera, then is it moral to sick your fan base on the suits.
It's not, but see, here's my thing. The morality is not about where you sick your fan base. The morality is choosing to activate your fan base in that way.
But isn't it just a direct action? Like, isn't this the same as call your senators?
I think that the nature of stan behavior is inherently more chaotic, less reliable, and more potentially, even legally problematic than call your senator.
But would she even have to explicitly say that for this to happen?
That's like, I think, no. And I think we'll get to that in the part two.
I think that's what you're picking up on as the contentious part of this. But I think even if she just posted that note and didn't say at the end, go it after her.
Of course.
They would have done that.
Actually, probably a pretty good transition into the other things we want to talk about, which are much more implied.
Yes.
And this applies also to, you know, we've seen this a lot with, say, the Beehive, right? Beyonce is certainly never out here
speaking
directly to the Beehive and giving them any sort of instructions.
Although low-key, the last time I did a Beyonce podcast, I got like a random tweet or an email from someone who like identified a thing in like 2012.
Right, that she had done.
Like I was just like, never directly, da-da-da. And of course, one person was like, in fact. So anyway, shouts to that person.
I've done some of this research and tried to find Beyonce referring directly to her fans, and it is very few and far between.
Yeah.
You know, hearing her say the words Beehive is like, it's super, super, super rare if it exists at all. But,
billionaire.
When you think of something like Becky with the Good Hair, which was a time that the Beehive swarmed, and they swarmed the wrong person.
Oh, yeah.
Remember Rachel Ray got some of the brunt of Lemonade? Again, that was just from a song lyric, and they did their thing totally without direction.
Which is how fan armies fundamentally work. But to be fair, Swifties are not like the Navy. They're not like the Little Monsters. Like, they're not, as you said, they're a posse fan base, broadly speaking. They're like,
they've gone after people before.
But it's not
like,
as,
shout out to the Jonas Brothers.
Right, but they're not like they're like the Barbs.
Yeah, they're maybe not as confrontational as some of the more confrontational fan groups, which I think is a point we've made on previous podcasts.
Yeah, and I think you're right. This is a good moment to pivot, but to me, the thing that I found kind of most agitating is I think, look, there's a covenant between a superstar and her or their fans. And I think there was something in the spirit of that note that violated the covenant. And maybe it's implied and it's not written down and I'm overreading or I'm making distinctions between fan armies that I shouldn't be making. But when Taylor says, in essence, you work for me, go do this, that to me is not actually what Taylor Swift fandom is about. Not to like get all in my feelings about it, but like that's not how I experience personally my Taylor Swift fandom. I don't think it's how the average like 12 to 18 year old young woman experiences their Taylor Swift fandom. And it felt a little manipulative and like a little loose at the edges to just sort of be like, you're weaponized now.
Well, I also think, too, so much of what we're talking about today is just about power imbalances and how those power dynamic is shifting so much in a digital world. But, you know, just thinking about what a common occurrence this is, that artists sign away their masters when they sign a bad contract or something like that. Taylor Swift is in a position of huge privilege and power to have this fan base. Like, I think if she ends up getting her way because she's able to sick millions of people on the people who have opposite interests from her, it does feel a little unfair to the artists that are maybe like more independent and don't have that sort of the fan base in numbers.
Maybe she can loan them out.
Right.
There
well,
you
I
go.
Think maybe
yeah.
she can contract them. You know, yeah.
I think what Taylor would say to this, and like what you've seen in some of the other artists who have spoken up with her, like I think of someone like Sky Ferreira, who spoke up last time Taylor posted on Tumblr and said, like, you know, maybe Sky doesn't have the same fan base that Taylor does, but she's someone who's been in the music industry since she was a teenager and felt wronged in a lot of ways. And she's sort of saying, it's meaningful to me to have somebody speak up on this scale. And I think the explicitness of the call to action in this Tumblr post was really an escalation. Taylor saying, like, this is so bad for me that I'm willing to take this drastic step.
Yeah, I think the title of the note was, I don't know what else to do.
Right,
yeah.
Don't know what else to do. That's like, you know, and whether or not you believe that this is coming from an earnest place probably has a lot to do with how you feel about Taylor Swift in general, but It was a nuclear button.
It was. And it was basically at the first available opportunity to press the nuclear option. Because this is, relatively speaking, these are not huge things. But it was the first available option. Now, I'm someone who believes that Taylor is both sincere and also extraordinarily cynical. And I do believe that I think she does know what else to do. I'm sure there's like a literal whiteboard in her offices with a list of 25 things that are currently ongoing that are other things to do. But the sort of show of public force, it's a play for her fans. It's a way of making her fans invested in her legal and corporate struggles, which is, yeah, maybe it's powerful and it is inspiring to some. But I wonder if it's exactly the right use of all that kind of like loose fan energy.
It was a business move. It was a legal strategy, which is in a lot of ways unapologetically Taylor Swift. I mean, it mm-hmm. kind of reminds me of the whole Apple letter and all the times when she's stood against Spotify, where she has this outsized power in the industry and is representing and talking about these issues that affect other artists that don't have that platform.
And she has affected change in the past.
Yeah, even as it's working in her self-interest, she's at least bringing these conversations to light and we're having them. And I think that's not for nothing.
I think those other people were scared. I actually don't know if Scooter or Scott are scared. That's the thing. Because like Spotify lives and dies by like, do people want to pay for their product? Will people like Taylor Swift pay for their product?
Yeah. Well, I think Scooter and Scott have another. Now, so that's true. We can ask them directly.
Should we pivot to the Taylor Swift of the streets, Lana Del Rey?
Let's do it.
Let's listen to Mariner's Apartment Complex.
Sadness out of context at the Mariner's apartment complex. I ain't no candle in the wind. I'm the boy, the lightning, the thunder, the kind of girl who's gonna make you wonder who you are and who you've been. And who I've been is with you on these beaches. Your Venice bitch, your diehard, your weakness. Maybe I could save you from your sins. So kiss the sky and whisper to Jesus. My, 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 you found this, you need this. Take a deep breath, baby, let me in.
So something that at least one person at this table has learned over the years was that if you write something about Lana Del Rey that she is not fully in favor of, you might have your name. This is me I'm talking about.
You might have your name printed in a German newspaper.
Might be printed in a German newspaper and then later put on a mug by one of your best friends. So, so Lana reads her press, or has it read to her? I don't know. But Lana is someone who over the last decade has, she had a rough entry.
From a scarring experience.
She comes by it honestly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was there for that. I took my lumps.
You took your shots first.
Yes. Well, I reread that, and it wasn't as bad as I remember it being.
The first paragraph is pretty brutal.
I took my shots. I'll own it. And
you regret it, do you not?
We'll get to that.
All right.
Okay.
We'll get to that.
Y'all let the critics fight this one
out. The point being that Lana is a person who is, unlike a lot of artists, Lana is a person who's extraordinarily attuned to things that are said about her and written about her. So a couple of months ago, Ann Powers, who is a music critic at NPR, been writing for decades, extraordinarily well-respected, very beautiful writer, wrote this very long contemplative essay about Lana Del Rey and Lana Del Rey's persona and also how it relates to California and the history of California music. It's like the type of essay that when I read it, I was like, why don't I have more time to write? I really want like more time to write. Like
sweeping overview of Lana's career.
And it's like, is everything in there fawning? No, of course not. But it's the type of thing, and I try to express this to artists when I have the opportunity to do that. to be taken seriously by someone who's, they could write an essay about that, about literally anyone, and they've chosen to write it about you.
It's an honor.
I like to believe it
it's
is.
It's an honor.
Yeah, I like to believe it is. There's limited critical bandwidth. If you are fortunate enough to be on the receiving end of it, that means you're doing something right. Lana went on Twitter and did the quote tweet with Anne, I think. Did she do the quote tweet or did she do the...
I think it was just an at.
Okay.
And not even a dot at. It was...
Oh, it was a straight...
I think dot at's not actually a thing anymore.
Yeah, it's Craven.
No, I think you don't even need to do it.
Yeah. Oh, no, I think it's been eliminated.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I think okay. it's... I think
people
it's,
still write the dot, but you... PSA, you don't need to write the dot.
I'm learning so this has much
been,
today.
This has been Tech Talk with Joe Coscarelli. So she added Anne...
Please read it.
Oh, my God. I had it up, and I... Man, where did it go? All right. So here's Lana Del Rey. I got to be honest. I like these tweets.
I mean, we need a flashback, really, to Lana versus Azealia Banks to really talk about Lana's 140-character darts.
Yeah.
I know we're at 280 now, but I think she kept them short.
Do you want to talk about Azealia real fast?
Nah, it's fine.
Okay. Google it
if you don't know it.
Just Google it. So here's Lana at replying to Anne. And the Anne tweet, it's just, you know, she put up the link and it says, open your heart to one more deep dive into the at Lana. This is the first, don't do that.
Don't at the artist?
Yeah, I don't
like at in some artists.
I don't at the artists. I'm not in conversation with the artist. I'm in conversation with myself and with the readers and da da da. I'm not in conversation with the artist. The artist wants to find it, they'll find it. Anyway, that's my only quibble here.
You at the artist?
I don't at the artist.
Yeah, it's my quibble. No quibbles with Anne's writing, but like this is my only quibble psychologically. Anyway, open your heart to one more deep dive into the at Lana Del Rey thing. This came out maybe 2 weeks after the record, after kind of like the initial critical spike had happened. Uh-huh. So it was a little bit in a vacuum when it dropped, if I remember correctly.
Maybe like a week after.
Yeah, a week. A week feels like 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, fair. Yeah. But it was not like day of
Monday after.
It was
breathing room.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I wish I could do a Lana Del Rey voice. I'm not going to try. Here's a little side note on your piece. I don't even relate to one observation you made about the music. There's nothing uncooked about me. Girl, me too. To write about me is nothing like it is to be with me. Also me too. Never had a persona. Never needed one. Never will.
She's a good writer.
She's so good.
I think there's another one too.
I'm coming.
Because my favorite line is in that.
So don't call yourself a fan like you did in the article and don't count your editor one either.
That's my favorite part.
Shouts to Lana Del Rey understanding the processes of journalism.
Yeah, I know.
We appreciate it. I may never have made bold political or cultural statements before because my gift is the warmth I live my life with and the self-reflection I share generously. I feel like I could have written these tweets.
So you relate.
I very deeply relate to all of these sentiments. So this is Lana being activated by, to be frank, and we can all talk about it, I'm not sure what.
The term persona is, I think, what she is really taking
issue with. It's been 8 years that, why, was it all saved up for this?
I don't know. Not defending it, I'm just saying that's the pressure point.
And the word persona is like the 1800th word in this piece.
Yeah, and also I would challenge her or her people to find a review or that a piece about her that does not use that
like
word.
Like, why this piece?
Yeah, because
is it because
she said
she listens to Cypress Hill? Like, I don't know. Like, I don't get it. So I was a little vexed. And it really spoke, I think, about our current moment, which is here's Anne, top-tier critic, writing probably the most effortful thing that she wrote this year. And what it will be remembered for, sadly, is Lana just, like, coming out for the quick drag. That's what it'll be remembered for.
So we quickly get the fans piling on, right? And not because Lana says, go get her, but because she added her back.
Yes, absolutely. So, Lindsay, when you saw this, did you have a twinge of kind of like, there but for the grace of God go I, kind of?
No, so I remember reading
You brought the hammers out? You're like, let's go to war?
No. Well, I remember reading Anne's beautiful and just very nuanced piece. I reread it on the way here on a very delayed subway train.
Yes.
And it just, I still think it's a brilliant piece of criticism and nuanced in a way that, you know, Lana Del Rey birthed 1,000 hot takes. Mm-hmm. And everything she does, there's sort of the hot take economy of just, you know, polarizing opinions about her. And this, to me, this piece was like the opposite of that.
Yeah.
So to single this out, and, you know, I think you would have to even, you have to kind of read far into it. I don't know how many words it is, but it's a long piece. Mm-hmm. And to even get to anything negative or possibly ambivalent, you have to get pretty deep into what is already a lot of praise for her.
I couldn't tell if she thought it was, not that it wasn't praiseful enough, but that it was almost like you're overthinking, you're kind of like...
Yeah.
Which is something you hear a lot from
artists.
Yeah,
like you're applying a kind of critical energy to me that is not consistent with like the energy in which I live my life. And that's the risk of being a critic, is that this is what we do. Y'all do what y'all do.
Uh-huh.
And just for clarity's sake, I didn't want to have this segment of Popcast just basically be like, we stan all critics and we think that everything a critic does is always flawless and artists can never say anything. It's not that. I'm just very particularly curious about the ways that these situations have shown how the power imbalances of the current social media era are basically completely wrecking the possibility of nuanced criticism for someone like an artist like this.
Yeah, because I remember reading the piece and just thinking it was brilliant. I texted it to a few people, I remember, before, because it kind of a day or so went by before she, Lana, tweeted about it. And then I saw that and I was just like, oh, no, mm-hmm. not this way. Like,
right. There,
I think that Lana Del Rey in particular can have... A lot of the things that have been written about her in the past have been sexist and have been really misguided and strange. I have been accused of those crimes and things that I've written about her in the past.
Did you pan Born to Die for Pitchfork?
I did. So,
wow.
Yeah, and there is no...
What was the number on that?
It's a 5-something, I think.
What is the number now?
Yeah, what's the number now?
I know you didn't pick the number, but...
No, I didn't.
Drag whoever did. Drag them.
It's, I can't say.
Okay.
I still don't really like that record.
Okay, fair.
And that's why I don't regret that review. Maybe a few of the things that I phrased. I did.
You were young.
We
were all young.
It's true. I do know. So
not
I,
me.
I still get.
You were grown.
I'm younger now than I was then.
There's nothing that I've written that still generates as much present tense hate mail. I still get probably 15 to 20 emails a year about that Pitchfork piece.
Wow.
From 7 years ago. So her fan army, like,
is
particularly,
yeah.
I think...
They're very defensive because she's been very wounded.
But
I think
and she's a real one point. We should just, for context, Lana Del Rey is a real 1.0 social media scrum.
Phenomenon.
Yeah. Also. Like, yeah. When I reread my show review from her Bowery Ballroom show, and at that point she had 3 songs out. And it was maybe the first time that I can remember where... 1 or 2 videos of a completely contextless artist had stirred up quite so much fever for who knows what. Maybe people were bored. I think what ultimately happened is the systems that were being put in place in the early 2010s that we now take for granted are reliant upon storms like this in order to function. There just were no storms at that time.
Yeah.
So turning Lana into a storm was sort of like the system coming into its own. And now there's a storm 5 times a day.
Right.
And we don't think of it as novel anymore. But in that moment, when I was rereading, I was struck by how not all the things that I was writing are like completely normal now. But at the time, they were absolutely irregular.
I
and
think
we
it
have to remember
really...
that she was birthed into that.
Yeah, it was a time, because just as having been a young woman coming up as a critic at that time, it felt like one of the first wave of the type of identity politics that we employ as a vocabulary just on the internet now were first kind of coming to the fore. And it was still kind of a... just below the mainstream to be talking
runoff,
about
sort of
feminism in the context of her. And
wow.
That was some of even the blowback that I felt. But I think...
Wait, should we just play a song from early launch with video games?
Yeah, go.
All right, let's bump video games. Still don't love this song, but let's bump it.
But you get it.
I get it. Yeah.
It's you, it's all for you. Every everything I do. I tell you all the time, heaven is a place on earth with you. Tell me all the things you want to do. I heard that you like the bad girls, honey. Is that true? It's better than I ever even knew. They say that the world was built for two. Only worth living if somebody is loving you. Maybe now you do.
Point too, that I have come to really love her later albums. I still don't think that record was the fully realized version of her that she got to. And I think that is another one of the dangers, is that when you're just, when the stan culture is anything that's not a going with you, we're gonna attack, doesn't leave room for the artist to evolve.
I think it's interesting to note, though, in this is like Lana was coming off of the best reviews of her career. I think a lot of times you get these artists lashing out at critics
on the down
at moments when they feel wounded and vulnerable. Like Nicki Minaj, for instance, you know, when we talked about the Juana's World stuff and Nicki, you know, going at that fan, she was having a hard time.
Like, yeah, it was a
nothing
tough stretch.
Was hitting. You know,
Cardi was on the rise.
Yeah, like Nicki was down and out in that way. Lana was riding high. And that's when my question is like, what's the cost benefit here? Like, this album is universally raved, essentially, including in this piece.
Yes.
And yet, this is the moment you choose to lash out at a critic. And I
felt
the same way.
People carry their trauma. And she's enacting the trauma of 8 years ago and 6 years ago. I mean, it's still clearly
with
her.
But I feel the same way about Lizzo, who's another artist who did this recently, you know, with a Pitchfork review, which again, like, what does a Pitchfork review matter to Lizzo? She took over the world in 2019.
Let's listen to Truth Hurts, not DaBaby version.
I was going to say, are you going to play DaBaby version?
I'm not going to play
DaBaby. We've already played it, right?
I know, but I mean, I feel like playing DaBaby version would be like a cheat to get me to kind of like the song more than I do. So let's play the original Truth Hurts.
We don't do goodbyes, we just keep it pushing like aye, aye, aye. Wild men gray till they gotta be gray. Don't text me, tell it straight to my face. Best friend set me down in the salon chair. Shampoo press get you out of my hair. Fresh photos with the bomb lighting. New man on the Minnesota Vikings. True hurts needed something more exciting. Bum, bum, be dumb.
To be fair, with the and the Pitchfork review is written by Rawia Kamir. Rawia has been on Bobcast before. This is also, I thought, the exact right thing to say about Lizzo, which
it was
is that
also a brilliant it was review.
Mean, but it was mean.
It was mean. Yes,
there was
it was meaner.
Some real
yeah, there were real
darts.
Shots in here, but also like she's taking issue with not just Lizzo, the performer and the musician, but also with some of the broader contextual things of kind of just presenting relentless positivity and, you know, that being the aestheticization of that.
I thought it
and
was a very
important.
Measured negative, quote unquote. I think it
and
was
I
like
don't
a
think it, ultimately,
6.5 or
yeah,
something.
And
which,
I actually don't think it was as mean as it felt in the kind of like heat of the thing. Not that there aren't shots. There's definitely shots.
Yeah.
But Lizzo responded. I don't have the thing in front of me, but in essence said, if you don't perform music or you don't play music, then you should not be allowed to write music criticism.
You should be unemployed.
You should be unemployed.
Which is a...
Did she mean unemployed like you can't work at like Jack in the Box? Or did she mean unemployed like you shouldn't have a job writing music reviews?
You would have to...
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll say that's a common argument. Like, it's not, you know, that has faced music criticism since the dawn of the art form, which I do believe it is an art form.
Yes.
But.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, but.
No, really.
But. No. That's an argument that I just have no patience for.
Yeah.
Which is like, we don't apply that to any other field.
But just the word unemployed is very loaded for journalists
in this particular moment.
That was kind of the lightning
rod. Do you think Lizzo is unaware of the firing?
The struggles?
Do you think she's unfamiliar with Deadspin? And do you think she's unfamiliar with, like, all the labor issues that are happening in online media and the unionization of
digital
media? If
she's not,
media?
I'd be happy to fill her in.
Look, she had a busy year.
That's true.
Give her that.
Yeah. But that...
You would think her positivity would extend to...
Condé Nast.
Yes, to those of us who wish to have gainful employment writing about the things that we are passionate about.
But I think it was a similar thing where that record has been a huge commercial success this year. She has had a lot of goodwill from other critics. It kind of felt like the one negative thing that anyone said about her, even though I feel like it was one of those reviews that I've had conversations in private about.
Mm-hmm.
Lizzo's music.
Feeling that way about,
like,
Lizzo.
There were a lot of people that felt that way and I think couldn't articulate it as well as Raulia did.
There's kind of a relentlessness
there's
on
like
that
a cult
record
of
that is
positivity
tough.
Around
and
her.
It's
yeah.
and it's tough to disentangle, like, I support this artist being successful and, like, getting a tremendous amount of attention while also saying these songs, I don't know. There was also a great tweet from Andrew Nas the other day who said Lizzo is just Macklemore, which is, I think
Nas
really
is going
to
be mad that you said this. Nas' Twitter is very private. It's not like retweets.
It's okay.
It's very locked.
He got a lot of faves on
it's
that.
Very locked.
There were a lot of, well, then all his locked people faved it.
We'll say all and his locked people listen to podcasts also. a lot of them.
Yeah,
these
but
Venn
all,
diagrams overlap.
Although, to be fair, I don't think all his locked people have listened to either Lizzo or Macklemore, probably.
Fair.
But I do think that it's, especially with someone who has such a public narrative as Lizzo, and especially over the last, like, 18 months, writing about... You know, people get acclimated to reading coverage of Lizzo that's positive and that's look at the arc of success. And that is the framework for almost all the coverage. So when someone comes in and says yes to all that, however, these songs, not so much. That's tough for a lot of people to take, Lizzo among them.
I want to ask you guys a question. I did this a little bit with the Taylor thing.
I've never dragged a Postmates driver. Is that the question?
We're not going to get there. I'm not going to go there.
Okay.
I support criticism.
I think it
should exist.
Thanks.
I support nuance.
Oh, my gosh.
I think it should exist.
Wow.
Is it really that bad to be dragged by a fan army? Look, okay.
At Karen Gans, at Matt Patrol.
Yeah, look, okay. Okay, death threats.
Yes.
People posting photos of your children. People calling your job trying to get you fired. That's a line that should not be crossed. That's a line we saw crossed, I think, very badly in the Nicki Minaj example.
Yes, of course.
From, you know, a while back. In the case of Lizzo and Lana Del Rey, you know, Anne, I think, wrote about the fallout from this.
Yep.
But ultimately... I come down on the side of, like, they put out their art for public consumption.
Mm-hmm.
We put out our writing for public consumption. People like it. They don't like it. You get a lot of tweets from BTS fans for a week, whatever. You shut your tweet deck. It's really annoying. But ultimately, like, I can only think of the Tyler, the Creator tweet where he's just like, and I'm going to paraphrase because there's some language here, but he just says, like, ha, 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 ha. How is cyberbullying real? Just walk away from the screen. Close your eyes. Ha, ha. Like, what is the real damage here?
Okay, but first
That's
of all,
just, who, it's a little okay. bit devil's advocate.
No,
but, yeah. I
but
hear
here's the
you
answer to that
think.
Question. Who among us is able to actually close their eyes in the current social media era? Number two, there is something curiously intimate about mentions on social media. How anytime you get a mention, it could be from, like, one of your 10 closest friends, or it could be from a complete troll with, like, 7 followers saying horrible things about you.
And again, women, people of color, like, this is a different
way worse,
thing.
Way, way, way
obviously.
Worse. I believe that basically the...
John, I'm basically saying, man up. It's
thank
all
you.
Good.
I will man up in many other ways, but fundamentally, I believe in civility of discourse.
Okay.
I also think if an artist wants to speak back, I actually completely am into that, but I would prefer to be on the merits. Like, that's maybe a thing that is getting lost in here. It's like, for you to be like, you have to play music to review music,
right?
That's obvious nonsense.
But Lana went a little further.
I agree, and I almost feel like I'm sympathetic. When I read the Lana thing, I'm not necessarily like, I'm on Team Lana, but I understand that reaction.
But you think it should have been a DM?
Maybe like a handwritten note, like a parchment or something?
Well, I think as we're saying too, Anne's response was incredibly gracious and really...
Of course.
Because, yeah.
Because Anne's an adult.
Exactly. And she said, you know, she didn't respect Lana any less, was like, I still love this album. That was a very mature way to handle it and kind of shut down, you know, and I think at the end of the day, it drove more people to read that lovely piece of criticism than they would have otherwise. And probably the same with the Pitchfork review, though who can know?
But do you feel like either the Lana case or the Lizzo case was an abuse of implied power in the way that Taylor explicitly asked for the, like, put up the bad signal? I don't think Lana was even implicitly putting up the bad signal. I think Lana was just
knows what her
you think she knows.
Like,
you think she was doing it? I guess I was willing to extend her the kind of like I was in a mood. I mean, I looked at the time of the tweet. It was at night. It's like,
look, I think
I was
that's
in my bag.
Probably true. I think it was probably impulsive, but also she knows that anybody in the Lana Del Rey universe, positive or negative, if she mentions you, you get an influx. Like, period.
Another point too is that both of these artists have dealt with sexism, racism, in ways that they've been written about. And there's kind of this narrative happening, like, in the film world, too, of just, like, straight white men reviewing something. And both of these critics that were attacked were a person of color, a woman of color, and a woman who was very feminist. Mm-hmm. And that part of it felt particularly unfortunate, too, of just, like, if you're gonna...
They're not the real enemy.
Yeah. So, okay, Joe, you think Lana knows what she was doing. And I think there's a moment in the Lizzo arc where Lizzo is very aware of what she's doing, and that is Lizzo v. Postmates. And this is really where I start thinking about the ethics of social media, and you say, Joe, like, man up. And it's like, well, yeah, on the one hand, but on the other hand—
I don't mean the Postmates driver.
No, but if, no.
Not a professional critic.
Not a professional critic, not someone who's out here looking to take shots.
Doesn't
and,
have
like,
NPR or
shots.
The New York Times behind them.
Right.
You know.
But if you really want to see the imbalance— that having a famous person sick the internet on you, this is actual cyberbullying. So Lizzo ordered Postmates. This is not Spawn, either pro or con Postmates. Lizzo ordered Postmates. Sidebar, why can I never get fries from Shake Shack when I order on Postmates? Really weird.
So you're calling out your Postmates driver?
I'm just saying. No, I'm calling out the enterprise.
Okay.
So Lizzo didn't give the phone number or didn't give a complete address. I mean, who can say? But somehow the driver did not connect. And then Lizzo screen grabbed the driver and put the driver on social media and was basically like, this is terrible.
She said they stole my food, right?
Yes.
I think the Postmates driver is suing Lizzo. Is that correct?
I think that's
right. That's the latest development in this story.
And the Postmates driver got doxed, I guess, and like discuss, and this is not a good thing, and this is ultimately when you have all these resources at your disposal, I do think there's like a moral and ethical valence to them and like how you weaponize them. And that's why I think I was frustrated by the Taylor thing, because I saw her handling her fans in a way that she has not previously handled her fans. And the Lizzo thing, this is like some real low stakes, like, you know, like my chicken tenders and pho didn't show up, and like all of a sudden, like this poor person's life is just ruined for months.
And it's about the power dynamic again. It's about the artist not understanding, or maybe understanding and coming from a place that of questionable morals for someone like a very famous pop star to sick their fans on a Postmates driver. Is the optics of that are not great.
They're terrible.
Yeah, I'll say, look, this is a much less interesting and controversial case because it's pretty clear. Like, Scott Borchetta and Scooter Braun are obviously not on the same level as a Postmates driver. Like,
no.
They're public figures, they are very rich men, etc. The only thing I'll say is Lizzo got really famous really fast. Like, there's probably something she would have done, you know, 2 years or even 18 months ago, and it would have been like pretty normal, right? Like,
So the big takeaway from this episode is you are pro artist dragging.
Look, no, I'm just asking the questions.
This is a hard pivot to PR consulting for artists.
I'm just trying to make this conversation more interesting than saying everyone is bad except us.
I totally agree. And again, the thing that I was really excited about with the Lana thing is I do think on some level it was on the merits to be like, you have said that I reference or am influenced by A, B, and C, and I do not believe
that. Yeah, there was, a particular part that she was taking offense at is there's a part in the piece where Anne is comparing side by side Joni Mitchell lyrics to Lana Del Rey lyrics, which, like, most people's bars are going to pale in comparison to any given Joni Mitchell lyric. Like, it felt a little bit apples and oranges. But then I think she brought it back around to a point of the way that Lana Del Rey is putting lyrics together and putting this pastiche of American signifiers and just other songs that she references. Like, it's a different kind of virtuosity. And it got back around to there, but I think the reading that Lana took away was like, yeah, I'm not Joni Mitchell. Like,
should we maybe close out with what I feel is like maybe the funniest recent artist v. critic blow up?
Yeah, but does that mean we have to listen to a JPEG Mafia
song? It does.
Song?
Okay. It does. Well, you're about to get added by him on Twitter for that. So just FYI.
Not listening this far.
So,
this is why we're against searchable podcasts, by the way.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, who's pro searchable podcasts?
It's happening.
I know it's happening. Yeah, we're going to have to. That's, man.
Opt out.
I can't wait to have that conversation. Anyway. Okay, so Al Pierre, Al works for Pitchfork. Al's been on podcast a couple times. If you follow Al on Twitter or have listened to him on podcast, you know that he has a robust sense of humor, a troll quality to him.
Youthful exuberance music.
But to me, in like a very loving way. Like, it reminds me a lot of like if I had like had a Twitter when I was 22 and like didn't have any concerns about my future career. So I very much respect expressing your love and also your distaste through this mechanism, especially while he still has a job, which, you know, there are plenty of people who do this who don't have jobs. So the fact that he still does it while he has a job, I find very admirable. So anyway, Al wrote on Twitter last month, there was some kerfuffle, burgeoning beef with JPEG Mafia. JPEG Mafia is a sort of like avant rapper from Baltimore, I guess, like post Death Grips. I actually don't hate JPEG Mafia. I know a lot of people do. I think JPEG Mafia is fine. So Al says, somebody tell JPEG Mafia no hard feelings. I just grew up on the classics like Nav. So his music doesn't hit like that for me, which is just like obvious humor. It's obviously funny. He clearly doesn't like JPEG Mafia, but he's also like locating it in a humorous context.
Nav.
Yeah. Nav. That's more of a shot to Nav than anything.
Yeah.
If anyone has a right to be.
And then JPEG Mafia responds. And he was not added, I want to emphasize. He was not added in this tweet. So he just tweet deck name searched himself and said, I want you to say this to my face. And then posts his tour dates and says, hit me up, little boy. What's up? Say it to my face. I'm in New York next month. Now, as far as I know, JPEG or Peggy, as he is known, and Al have not fought the fair one. Like, there's no one's pulled up, as far as I understand. But there's also a thing where JPEG Mafia continually refers to Al as Conde,
which is really funny.
It's super funny. Like, you know, as if like, it's like Will Welch from GQ, like reviewing the JPEG Mafia.
It's a corporate problem. It's Anna.
Yeah, right. There's like a mandate from the top down. But then the punchline is if you search tweets on JPEG Mafia's account, you will stumble on some from late December 2018 after a different writer, Paul Thompson, had written something very positive about the last JPEG Mafia album called Veteran. And then JPEG Mafia at that point was extremely excited and said, all hail Condé Nast. And then in a different tweet said, I hope 2019 is a good year, ... This tweet is sponsored by Condé Nast. Condé giveth and Condé taketh away.
Did he write that or that was your commentary?
No, that's me.
The giveth and the taketh is me.
That is my dry commentary on the situation. So, you know, it was interesting to see the kind of like online discourse going up because like Al has a very big Twitter following and JPEG Mafia has a similar size Twitter following, but like different kind of folks. And in a weird way, this is a fairer fight.
Right.
Like all
it's
the
JPEG Mafia.
Yeah, like all the fights we've been talking about have been fundamentally asymmetric, unfair fights. This is sort of a fair scrap. You know, I don't want anything negative to come out of it. I don't want anyone to pull up on anybody. But I saw this and I was like, LOL, like here's Al trolling, understanding that there's like a potential cost that comes with trolling. Here's JPEG Mafia, who like maybe low-key is happy to be spoken about.
Yeah, and trolling back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's look, a tweet via a tweet. Yeah. Too. It's
and
not
ultimately
like...
ultimately we're learning about the media literacy of our favorite artists.
Yes.
Lana knows about the editing structure.
Yes.
JPEG Mafia knows about corporate ownership.
And Lizzo knows that we all got kicked out of band.
Yeah. And Taylor Swift knows about private equity.
Yes.
So here we are.
That's true.
We learned so much in the last hour.
So I guess I want to close out with a JPEG Mafia song. Joe, if you want to leave the studio.
No, look, I'm not mad at JPEG Mafia. It's just not Popcast core.
Wow. What?
You think it is?
I have to think about that.
It's not like Dan and Shay. When I taste
Keita. Yeah, it wouldn't go on the 3-disc greatest hits soundtrack.
No, that's fair.
Popcast.
That's fair. But this song is actually pretty good. So let's go out with Jesus Forgive Me, I Am a Thought by JPEG Mafia.
Great title.
Pray you get comfy in your disguise. Pray for my thoughts on the other side. Pray for my children I can't provide. I feel 45. Pray when you shoot us on the side. Pray for my haters, they terrified. Kill me, I'm verified. But I'm still alive.
That's our show. Thank you to Lindsay Zolads. Thank you to Joe Coscarelli. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Listen to JPEG Mafia wherever one listens to JPEG Mafia. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio content. Google Play. Apparently Pandora. I did an ad for Pandora, and apparently someone heard it in the bodega, so I guess they used it. So shouts to them. And email us maybe your favorite JPEG Mafia song, or perhaps your favorite artist critic beef. We actually didn't really get into historical stuff. Lindsay, you would email me earlier.
Yeah.
There's great Chris Gow stuff.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I remember talking to Bob back in the day about Bob kept files of everything that any person had ever sent him, including some horrific things from musicians that he had dragged.
Wow. Yeah. Lou Reed versus Bob Chris Gow. That's my personal favorite. Look it up.
That might like a part two.
Yeah.
At some point.
None of the words we can say on
So, you know, back when there were stakes to this. Anyway, if you have any other particular favorite artist critic beefs, email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Our producer in the room is Dan Powell. At home is Fader Rosado from Matt Stepper Media. We will be back sooner than you think. But I don't want to make all my peers resign. 35, I'll be 45. They say the church believes all beyond.